Okay, hello, my name is Jessica Trotter, and I'm a librarian at the Capillaria District Library, and I'm thrilled to be talking with professor and author Samuel R. Delaney, the lead-off instructor for the 38th Clarion Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers Workshop at Michigan State University. Samuel R. Delaney is the author of both fiction and nonfiction, including About Writing, Babel 17, Einstein Intersection, Empire Star, Dahlgren, and Eye and Gomorrah. He has received multiple Hugo and Nebula Awards, the Lambda Pioneer Award, the Pilgrim Award, honoring a lifetime of contributions to science fiction and fantasy scholarship, and in 2002, he was inducted into the Science Fiction Hall of Fame. Thank you for being here, Mr. Delaney.
It's very, very nice of you to have me here.
In preparing for this interview, I did a lot of reading and research, but it was actually wandering through my bookshelves at home that brought me this question. On a shelf, I found Clarion, an anthology of speculative fiction and criticism from the Clarion Writers' Workshop.
Probably the first book that the Clarion that came out under the auspices of the Clarion Workshop many years ago.
I think it's a 1970 publication. I believe it came out right after your first stint.
Right.
With Clarion.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Your essay is actually quoted on the back, mm-hmm. and it says, SF has been approached from many new directions. The Clarion Workshop is one of the most exciting. So what was it that was so exciting to you, and what keeps bringing you back?
Well, first of all, the Clarion Workshop is a working workshop. An awful lot of workshops are a case of pull out a story that you've done, one or two stories that you've done 4 or 5, sometimes 15 or 20 years ago, and you bring them, and then you don't do anything except workshop the stories, and you sit around, and and it's a very low pressure kind of thing. Clarion is a high pressure situation. In Clarion, we got started last night. We had our orientation, and the kids went at 9:45 after orientation, they went home and started working. Mm-hmm. And they will work almost nonstop for 6 weeks. The number of Clarion students who have told me again and again that this 6-week session is the hardest they've ever worked in their life is legion. It's a very high pressure situation. It's a life changing situation. I think a lot of people find out, one, just how hard being a writer is, because Clarion gives you a chance to be a writer for 6 weeks. You're working, you're producing, you're working in a very supportive group. In that sense, that's kind of ideal, an ideal part of the situation. On the other hand, it's a very high pressure and very work oriented situation. The classes run from 9 to 1 o'clock, and we critique 3 or 4 stories a day. Everyone in the workshop, and this is, we have a fairly large workshop this year. I think there are 22 people, so everybody gets about 2.5 minutes to have their say. They get very, very good at condensing their criticism and making them very pointed, and it helps them as critics, and presumably it helps them as writers too. And they keep working throughout the entire time, working and reading. The one thing you don't do is sleep. And so that's that's how Clarion works, and that's what makes it so different.
You spent a lot of time in the last few years teaching. Are you still at Temple?
Yes, I teach creative writing at Temple University.
Has all of this, well, what's the draw of teaching for you?
Well, for one thing, it pays the rent.
That's
and that's very nice. If you are, it's very, very hard to make your living as a full-time writer. I struggled as a freelance writer basically from the time I was 20 years old to the time I was 47, at which point somebody offered me a professorship in comparative literature at the University of Massachusetts, and my first response was, you must be mistaking me for someone who spells his name with an E before the Y. I can't see why anyone would want me to fulfill such a role. However, no, they really did. And so for the next 11 years, I was a professor of comparative literature at UMass. And then for 2 years, a year and a half, really, I was at SUNY Buffalo. Then I was hired away by Temple University, where I've been since 2000. Mm-hmm.
Has your experience as a teacher affected your writing?
I would imagine it has. I don't. It's very hard to tell you exactly how it's affected that. At least one novel that I did in 1995, a lot of it takes place on the landscape of on a university landscape, and I think that's, I'm sure, because I spent, you know, a few years teaching. Although, as I wrote in my most recent book about writing, I don't think, I think after you've done something for a long time, you lose the bright, it loses its bright edge. And so something that you know too well, and I now know about teaching pretty well, I know a fair amount about it. You know, I've been head of my department and in a rotating head situation. And so that I don't have the kinds of impressions that you have after you've just been doing something for a few months, where everything is new and bright and shiny, and well, I don't have anymore. Well, so for that reason, I probably wouldn't set another novel in a in a university. I'd want to do something that I just done for, you know, for a little bit. Yeah, that's an idea that I first heard articulated by or read in a book, E.M. Foster's The Aspects of the Novel, many years ago, and was, you know, pleasantly surprised to find out that Mr. Foster knew what he was talking about.
Okay. As a teacher and a writer, you've been a tremendous influence on the next generation of authors. I've read fabulous quotes from Neil Gaiman, who was just thrilled to have, when he met you, and you know.
Well, the thrill was mutual.
Yeah, that's what he was saying.
Neil is a very talented writer himself, and it was a delight and a pleasure to meet him as well.
Were there authors who influenced your writing? I mean,
certainly. I mean, you learn to write from other writers, and I think that goes. You know, Theodore Sturgeon was one of the great influences on my writing, I think, Catherine MacLean is I just saw her for the first time in many years at WISCON, WISCON 30, which was a convention in that's their 30th annual convention. And they were pulling together all their many guests of honor, and I had been guest of honor at the 11th WISCON, and Catherine had been guest of honor at another one. So we were both there for the 30th one, and it was a great pleasure to tell her just how much I learned from her when I first read, you know, collections of hers like The Diploids, you know, and The Other Man, you know, her novel, The Other Man. Because she's someone who's written a fair amount of science fiction, but she's not written a great deal of it. I mean, she hasn't, you know, she never glutted the market.
Right.
You know, her stories were sort of relatively rare and far between, and always of an extraordinary high quality.
Mm-hmm. So how did you come to writing science fiction?
I read it as a child. Of course, I read everything as a child. I mean, you know, you put a Kellogg's cornflakes box in front of me, and I read that, you know. I think you learn pretty much any genre basically by reading it. Whatever you read, you write. You know, or at least that's what the way. If I read a certain amount of criticism, I suddenly decide, hey, I want to write some criticism.
Yep.
If I read a certain amount of literature, I suddenly think, I want to write a literary story. If I read a certain amount of science fiction, I'm suddenly, oh, I think I want to write a science fiction or a fantasy story. And it goes basically, it's what, you know, what goes into the hopper grinds up, and it affects what comes out.
Mm-hmm. All of our listeners are not necessarily familiar with that work, with your work. Is there anything that you would suggest a person start with when approaching your work?
Well, that's a very hard question for any writer to answer. It's kind of, you know, who's your favorite child?
Who's your favorite child? Yes.
You know, and you're sure that if you actually do tell which was your favorite, all the others are going to come around and beat you up when, you know. And it depends on what you're interested in, because I write very different things. Okay. I very rarely is one book like another one. The book that has certainly been the most popular and the most people have read is a very long novel called Dahlgren, which was written back in 1975. That's the one that most people have read. People who like sort of hardcore science fiction adventure might like a book called Nova, which is in print from Vintage Books. People who like a slightly more idea-oriented science fiction might like a book called Babel 17, which is also an adventure, but it focuses on language and how language works, and so it's a bit of more idea-oriented a novel that perhaps might appeal to someone who's more interested in the poetics of language is a book called The Einstein Intersection. You pay as your money, you take your chances.
Yes, you do.
I have a more recently, in the last 20 years, I've written mostly non-science fiction. I've written things that are more recognizable as literary fiction, and there's a collection of three stories about African Americans called Atlantis: Three Tales, one of them is a short novel called Atlantis Model 1924, which takes place in 1924, and it's about a young African American who moves from Raleigh, North Carolina, to New York City, the way my father did in the same year. Then there's followed by two other short stories. One takes place in Europe in the 1960s, and the other one takes place in the 1950s in New York City. And about the problems of a young African American going to an all-white public school, which I did. The first story is sort of based on tales my father told me about coming to New York as a 17-year-old and during Jazz Age Harlem, which is when the story is set. And the other stories are, as I said, are based on things that happened to me. Mm-hmm. So that's another kind of story,
right?
That somebody might like.
Mm-hmm. I really enjoy the way you use language, and I really
Thank you very much. I don't think you can compliment a writer more highly.
And one of the things, and actually I'm thinking both an Introduction to Dahlgren and both the William Gibson's Introduction to Dahlgren and Neil Gaiman's Introduction to Einstein Intersection.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them talked about what you don't tell a reader. And that's something I actually it keeps stories with me.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a conscious choice not to answer the questions?
It's very funny. If you'd been in the Clarion class this morning, you would have heard me telling students to do just the opposite. You should tell the reader as much as possible, I was decrying the story that leans too heavily on withholding information from the reader. What you want to do is you want to make leaps, and you want to make leaps across. I mean, those leaps are fairly large, but once you make the leap, you want the reader to have all the information between those leaps. And sometimes readers, there's a certain kind of writing that some readers can follow, and some find it difficult to follow those leaps. And so, for that kind of reader will often feel that information is being left out, and then the stories may be a little bit frustrating to the reader. And it's possible that some of my stories are frustrating to a reader because of that. I don't try consciously to frustrate the reader. I just want to make the leaps between the words, to go as far as you can possibly go. But I want the reader to leap with me. I don't want the reader to drop off between the words.
Sorry, I'm losing myself. Please hear. A lot of your work. A whole lot of your work has pushed the boundaries and explored sexuality, race, gender. Is that also a conscious something you needed to explore?
Yes, very much so. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things, if you look over the history of literature, the literature's entire history seems to be pulling more and more things into it. In before Dante, the language that people spoke wasn't part of literature. People spoke Italian, and you had to write your literature. All literature was written in Latin and Greek, and Dante did this revolutionary thing. He wrote, this big three-part poem in Italian, just like real people spoke around him. And it was a great and revolutionary act. You read the novels from what's sometimes referred to as the great tradition in the English novel. I believe Leavis was the one who came up with that phrase. And you read the novels in the great tradition, and if you were a Martian and you read this, you could come away from those novels and never occur to you that people had sex, or that they went to the bathroom, or there were a whole series of ordinary things that are ordinary parts of our ordinary lives that we do all the time and every day. And literature is almost predicated on, in any given age, there are things that are literature and there are things that are vulgar. The whole point for Dante is that he brought the Vulgate into literature, and with a novel like James Joyce's Ulysses, suddenly going to the bathroom was suddenly, could come into the literary circle. And because of that, because he brought that in, the book was was considered a filthy book, and was declared illegal for many years, right, until Judge Woolsey made his famous decision that this was literature. And I think by the same token, there are many, many acts and many, many things that we do that need to be brought in to literature. And every time we do it, once we become comfortable with it there, then people think, oh, well, what was the big deal, and you read those sections of, Bloom taking a bath, or Bloom, or, thinking his thoughts sitting on the commode, and you think, what's the big deal? But this was just revolutionary, right, in 1922 when this first appeared. This had just never been done before, or the only time you got anywhere near it was in pornography. Mm-hmm. But this seems to be the fundamental way that the growth of art works. It brings more and more things, right, in. One of the great things that's happened in the last 10 or 15, well, more than that, 25, 35 years, is the notion that women's day-to-day experience, can be a part of literature. Literature up until that time was, going off and fighting wars and having revolutions and what have you, but it couldn't be washing the dishes, or it couldn't be doing, folding up the laundry, or taking the kids to school. And you had to have an entire, a sort of feminist wave of literature to make that an acceptable topic, right, for real literature, and each decade there's another, we suddenly realize that there's something else that we haven't talked about that we've always thought been beneath the radar, as it were.
And one of my coworkers and I were talking about, and you may or may not be familiar with this, but the most recent Doctor Who series, mm-hmm, has introduced a gay character, and for the life of us, we couldn't come up with another one that isn't, about to be killed off within the next episode. Has the world, has science fiction and the writing world changed in a good way from when you were writing
I think it has. Yeah, the fact that in a perfectly nonsensical movie like Independence Day, there is the Harvey Fierstein character. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, he doesn't survive past the 20 minutes, but in 20 minutes he has to be safely killed off. But the point is, it always starts slowly.
And moves on.
I do think that when all is said and done, that, you know, you see it start, and you look at any individual example, and you think, you know, and you roll your eyebrows to heaven, and you think, you know, that's supposed to be a revolution. but by the same token, when you see it as part of a process and you see how it does move on, I think we really are making progress. You know, and it comes slow and never as fast as one would like it to come. No, absolutely not.
Not at all.
No.
Well, sort of step back here. Who are some of your favorite authors now?
Let me see. Who are some of my favorite authors now? I very much like, speaking of gay writing, I like Michael Cunningham, who wrote The Hours. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the closest things that we have to a great American novel written in the last decade. I think that's an extraordinarily rich work. I like very much some of Edmund White's work. Who else? There's a woman named Charlotte Bacon, who has written some very, very fine short stories, and a novel that perhaps is not as strong as some of her shorter works. It's called something, Geography is in the title. There's a woman named Erin McGraw, who's written some wonderful short stories, who I like, but I think they're just amazing things. And then there are, you know, there are lots. There's so many, you know, interesting young writers. Ethan Kanan. These are all people who've been around, you know, for 10 or 15 years. And there are, you know, and newer writers as well.
Is there anything you've read, any old favorites or recent reads that you think everyone should know about? Maybe some of the ones you've already mentioned.
But. Well, I probably would be. I think the one thing I'd want everybody to read is The Hours. I think that's such a fine, fine book. I don't think his second book, Specimen, or his next novel. It's not a second novel. The Hours, I believe, was his third or fourth novel. Specimen Bays, I don't think, is quite as strong, although it's a very ambitious work. It's an attempt to do three stories in different forms, an old-fashioned ghost story, a contemporary mystery, and then a far future science fiction story. And I don't think those, for some, he doesn't quite have the interplay of the genres, you know, under his belt in the way that he might well have. Nevertheless, the very fact that he tried it, I think, is really interesting, and makes him an interesting writer, you know. Other things, there's Mary Doria Russell, yes. Sparrow, and the books and the books that have come after that. I think those are really, really fine attempts. They deal with religion frequently, or religious topics, and these are things that I would ordinarily, you know, lift an eyebrow at, you know, but the way she does it, I think it works remarkably well. What is the name of Ship Fever, Rona Barrett? Ship Fever won the National Book Award about 7 or 8 years ago, and the last name is the writer, the woman who wrote the book, is Barrett. Very interested in science, not in a science fictional way. She's sort of more like the history of science, and works that into her novels, and it's very interesting the way she does it. So there are lots of good and interesting stuff going on.
I want to thank you for talking to me.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for asking the questions.